the commander established contact with us from the hot LZ. "We've got 113 dead," Smith cried. Timothy looked at me, incredulous. "He's panicking," I said. "There's no way he could take that many casualties in 5 minutes. And even if he could have, it would have been impossible for him to make any sort of accurate assessment in the time he had been on the ground. Under fire like that, everything becomes exaggerated. My biggest fear in the CNC was that the colonel was going to lose complete control of himself as well as the battle. But as one of the O2 officers opined later, Colonel Smith was never in control to lose it, and I believed it was true. From the moment the first elements of the O2 hit the ground at An Nin, it seemed that anything that could possibly go wrong with the operation went wrong, and with a vengeance. The landing zone Smith had chosen was outside the range of our artillery. The task force the Arty was moving with was being held up on the wrong side of a mountain range due to roads bogged by heavy rain or cut by the Viet Cong. Smith had knowingly taken this risk of being beyond the artillery fan. "I don't need artillery," he declared in response to Lieutenant Colonel William Braun's concern that Braun's 2nd of the 320th Airborne Artillery would not be able to support Smith's assault. "I've got my TAC air." The only problem was, come the morning of the operation, Smith did not have his TAC air. After the first two A1E Sky Raiders prepped the LZ and flew away, there was no TAC air at An Nin for a full hour and a half after the O2 landed there. Back at Queen Yan, it had been discovered that the fuel for the A1Es had somehow been contaminated and the planes were grounded. Until MACV scrambled jets out of Bien Hoa to pick up the TAC air slack, the O2, less helicopter gunships, was on its own. Meanwhile, up in our CNC bird, we received word that not one of the 26 troop-carrying choppers designated for this mission was still operational. All had taken multiple hits and could not fly. One of the faint-hearted suggested we tell the O2 to E&E, escape and evade, forgetting completely that this situation was, in fact, tailor-made for airborne. The airborne's very purpose was to drop behind enemy lines. Its men were trained to be surrounded and to fight in isolated pockets of resistance. So I called Grady Jones, who'd been traveling with the waylaid task force in a jeep outfitted with all our maps and S2, S3 gear. He parked on the side of the road, popped a smoke, and soon Timothy, Hicks, and I joined him on the ground to decide what to do next. Colonel Timothy organized another task force composed of elements of the 2nd of the 327th, the remnants of the two O2 companies that never made it to the battlefield, and elements of the 23rd Arvin Ranger Battalion. Captain Dwayne Messer, the Ranger's fine senior advisor, was authorized to send only two of his companies, but when he heard what a mess we were in, he brought the whole battalion anyway and said he'd worry about the legalities later. We had to tap the first air cav for lift, with every troop-carrying chopper attached to us down. Theirs were the only immediate air assets in the vicinity. But when Bob Miller, the Brigade S3 Air, called over to the air cav to request some helicopters, the cav's chief of staff said, "No way." "What do you mean, no way?" I yelled through the radio when Miller reported back to me. "That's what I said," he replied. "I told him we had a battalion getting the shit kicked out of it to protect the first cav's ass, and it'd be a nice idea if they'd give us a little support. He said they didn't have flak jackets, and flying without them would violate all their SOPs. Later I heard the cav's real bitch was that our action would cheat them out of a few of the 30 precious combat-free days they'd been promised in-country to get themselves set up at Anke. Word traveled fast that we were getting zapped. Before long, Lieutenant General John L. Throckmorton, Westmoreland's deputy, flew up from Saigon to find out who was responsible for this disaster and what the hell we planned to do about it. By then, we were locked and cocked except for the air cav's assets. Timothy explained the situation to the general. Throckmorton made a few calls, and the next thing we knew, the Flying Horseman, 1st Air Cav, came galloping to the rescue. Sort of. For reasons unknown, the cav dropped the 2nd Task Force, Task Force Collins, named for the 2nd of the 327th's CO, at an LZ not 2 kilometers from An Nin, as Colonel Timothy had chosen, but 5. This destroyed any hope of their linking up with and taking the heat off the O2 at all that day. Two daring aircav pilots did get much-needed ammo resupply and an 81mm mortar into the battle zone, though, and were able to evacuate five wounded before they had to break off because of heavy enemy fire. "The choppers weren't even landing," said one participant after the fight. "We were just throwing bodies in." On the ground, the battle was fought by the NCOs, who'd become the commanders by default, as the officers were, one by one, killed or seriously wounded, and Colonel Smith remained pinned down behind his paddy wall. But the biggest sting of the fight was word that Herb Dexter, who'd only recently transferred from Brigade S-4 to the O-2 as S-3, was also killed. In this, his fourth tour in Vietnam, he too had become a platoon leader in the effort to turn the battle around. He was hit five times as he led a small band of courageous paratroopers up a heavily fortified enemy-held hill that dominated the landing zone. "Don't pull back! Don't pull back!" he said as he died, and his men heeded him, taking the objective a short time later in hand-to-hand combat, with one brave trooper even storming an enemy mortar and ripping its sights off with his bare hands. The guys probably best off were the 36 who'd come in on the third lift. Though under constant attack, cut off from one another in groups of 8 and 28 men until noon, and then cut off together from the main body of the battalion the rest of the day, throughout the battle these men were in the good hands of Platoon Sergeants Robert Jack and Robert Whiteman, two old soldiers with years of combat between them. Whiteman had actually found himself in and fought himself out of a virtually identical cutoff situation a dozen years before in Korea. According to retired Lieutenant General Henry Hank Emerson, Bob Whiteman was one of the greatest combat leaders the Army was fortunate enough to have among its ranks. He was one of the greatest combat leaders Emerson had ever seen, and though the sergeant was well beyond the age limit, Emerson fought the bureaucracy to have him battlefield commissioned. In the end, though, it was Whiteman who refused the commission, telling Emerson he'd rather be a good NCO than a lousy officer any day. The O-2 troops performed magnificently throughout the battle, but never more so than in the early crucial hours in the absence of air support, artillery, and the commanders all had assumed would be there to lead them. They survived their baptism of fire with sheer guts. At one stage, late in the day, a recon man named Freeman even took five prisoners with his disassembled M16. The weapon had jammed, and he was cleaning it when he saw a VC patrol approaching him. He jumped up and pointed the barrel assembly at them. They threw up their hands, and he marched them into his unit's nighttime perimeter. Fortunately for all concerned, by mid-afternoon, TAC Air was in abundance, close to all that was available in-country. Bob Miller had so many planes stacked up, he had to provide alternate targets throughout the battlefield just to unload the ordnance. The first day's 47 airstrikes punished Charlie royally, suppressed a lot of his fire, and let our troops come up for air. But close-in requests within 100 meters of friendly positions during the belly-to-belly fighting accounted for two B Company deaths and a number of injuries throughout the day. By nightfall, the air cav had lifted the 2nd of the 320th Artillery into range of An Ninh. At our request, they also set up one of their own batteries nearby to support Task Force Collins, which was beyond the 2nd of the 320th's fan, and mistakenly proceeded to blast the shit out of Collins' CP. It wasn't the cav's fault. In the hurry and the heat of the battle, no one had thought to make sure they used the same artillery deflection as the 2nd of the 320th. Obviously, they did not. And it was just luck that among the 11 friendly casualties that resulted from the accident, no one was killed. That night, flare ships circled overhead, keeping the area lit up like day. By morning, the VC had gone to ground, and though Operation Gibraltar continued for two more days, with the 2nd of the 502nd being extracted and Task Force Collins mopping up the area, the worst was over. The net result of the fighting was friendly casualties of 13 KIA and 40 WIA, 12 of which were from friendly fire, for an enemy body count reported to be 257 KIA, most of the victims of our TAC Air. Only 21 enemy weapons were recovered, but 12 prisoners were taken, a number of whom were unquestionably hardcore NVA regulars, fillers infiltrated down to join VC main force units and buck up their southern counterparts. So much for North Vietnam's chant, "No NVA troops south of the 17th parallel." General Westmoreland, along with some 20 reporters, was at brigade headquarters at An Khe when the O2 was extracted. Colonel Smith was immediately flown there to meet him, to give his report and quash early press accounts that the O2 had been badly mauled at An Ninh. The following day, he was flown to Saigon to do it again for the press there. Though Smith had been pinned down throughout the first bloody day and destroyed most of his documents in anticipation of being overrun, he would receive a Silver Star for gallantry in action during the operation. His battalion was awarded a well-deserved presidential unit citation, though less for their tactical brilliance than for their guts and absolute refusal to give in. How lucky the unit actually was, in the earliest moments of the battle, to survive what ended up being the buzzsaw of a well-trained, well-armed main force VC unit would not be known until the first air cav captured the VC after-action report on Gibraltar some 6 months later. According to that document, the VC knew we were coming as soon as we started planning. The minute we'd informed the friendly Viets in the district that we were going into the area, the word was passed along to the VC. The 95th also had a pretty good idea where we would be landing, and for 2 days before the battle, they trained on position there. But since nothing ever goes exactly according to plan, as prepared as the VC at An Ninh had been to receive us, when the O2 made its initial air mobile assault, Charlie ended up being as surprised as we were. While huge pots of still-boiling rice, ammo, and other gear found by our troops in hastily abandoned enemy campsites told the tale on the ground, the VC after-action report filled in a noteworthy blank. As the initial A1E airstrikes and the first O2 lift went in, all the VC leaders, from squad level on up, were at their battalion CP, chalk-talking a sand table exercise of the expected battle. The airstrikes cut the phone wires between the battalion commander and his companies, and throughout the subsequent fighting, the VC troops fought as isolated bands with no guidance from the main boss. And at the outset of the battle, until the squad, platoon, and company leaders got back to their units from the battalion CP, the VC troops fought with no guidance at all. Just one irony of this could be seen in a story related after the battle by O2 recon man John Reed, in which, soon after they landed as part of the first lift, a number of O2 recon guys saw a dozen Viet Cong in black pajamas tearing across the river just beyond a tree line north of the LZ. The recon group opened fire, only to be stopped by their sergeant because the enemy did not appear to be armed. It was General Westmoreland's strict rules of engagement again, and these VC got away. But they were never identified, and the question would always remain, what if they'd been among the unit's platoon and company commanders? And if they were, how different would the battle have been had our recon guys killed them and the enemy lost all its key leaders as the O2 lost theirs? Operation Gibraltar, the first major battle waged by the U.S. Army in Vietnam, was hailed by General Westmoreland as a great victory for U.S. troops. To me, Gibraltar was many things, chief among them a learning experience. Among the necessity of artillery, the allowance of sufficient lead time before an operation, the worth of airborne training, even if airborne operations themselves were obsolete against a sophisticated enemy with TAC air and tactical nuclear weapons, instilling as it did the "they've got us surrounded, the poor bastards" fighting spirit that served the O2 troopers on the ground in An Ninh in fine stead. But one thing Gibraltar most definitely was not was a great victory. Later, one O2 officer participant diplomatically called it a blundering success. Another was a little more blunt when he said, "The VC saved the day by walking away," which, not at all to downplay the spirit and performance of the O2 soldiers or the professionalism of its NCOs, was indeed the case. Still, the great victory at Gibraltar sounded the start gun for many more big battles and many more great victories for American units in Westmoreland and Dupuy's search-and-destroy war of attrition. Brigadier General William E. Dupuy, Westmoreland's J-3 at the time, was and is widely considered the primary architect of the U.S. strategy of the Vietnam War. And while the 1st Brigade had learned plenty to arm it for the next confrontation with Charlie, so, of course, had the VC. Because of the tremendous losses in helicopters during Gibraltar, extracting troops from An Ninh, a function of the Brigade S-3 shop, was a slow, complicated, piecemeal process. Still, Bob Miller, the S-3 heir and a truly exceptional officer, he was also a VMI boy from Colonel Johns's days as commandant and loved the old man as much as I did, had things under control. The redeployment was going smoothly when Major Charles W. Bill Dyke, S-3 of the 2nd of the 327th, burst through the tent flaps of our S-3 tent, demanding assets to get his battalion out of the battle area. Bill Dyke was a hard-charging, super conscientious officer. So conscientious, in fact, that to me he always looked on the verge of going tilt. He reminded me of an overbred hunting dog, so finely tuned that all it could do was shake. As far as I was concerned, Dykes was not the kind of personality we needed around at the moment. Most of the Brigade S2-S3 staff hadn't slept in 3 days and tempers were reasonably short. In my case, I was holding on by a hair trigger. Nonetheless, Dyke came charging in demanding priority on air. My primary concern was getting the 2nd of the 502nd back on pre-Gibraltar station. Miller went on organizing just that, with Dyke breathing hot and heavy down his neck. Finally, I said, "Okay, Dyke, we're ready to outload your fucking battalion." "Don't call my battalion a fucking battalion," Dyke screamed in reply, and before I knew it, he came charging at me like a red-faced raging bull. Automatically, I put up my dukes, and the second he was in range, I hit him, not once, but 3 or 4 times, and knocked him on his ass right then and there. After he got his bearings, Dyke slowly got up from the deck and grabbed my hand. "Hack," he said, shaking it wildly, "you're a better man than I." What a weird guy, I thought to myself as he madly pumped away on my hand. This is one weird guy. By the time 1st Brigade left on K for Quy Nhon, the men were well on their way to becoming seasoned vets. Gibraltar had bloodied us and taught us to respect our foe. Overall confidence had steadily risen, both through the countless patrols and company and battalion-sized operations, and from observing the predominantly non-paratrooper 1st Air Cav guys going through their opening night jitters. How quickly our men had forgotten their own. Comments like, "What were y'all shooting at last night, Leg?" which had been heard from the moment the Air Cav arrived, now, on the eve of our departure, had given way to, "Hey, Leg, what are you going to do when we're not here to protect your ass?" About the same time that we moved out of An K, Colonel Timothy made good the promise he'd made me as far back as Fort Campbell about letting me go down to a battalion. I was thrilled. Brigade staff was no place for a warrior. Though I enjoyed working for Colonel Timothy very much, from the way things were shaping up, the war in Vietnam was one fought almost solely at platoon, company, and battalion levels, and a staff officer at brigade, division, and above was nothing more than a manager's assistant, a small cog in a huge paper-shuffling machine whose function was little more than matching assets against requirements and writing reports. I probably would have been happy with any job just to get off the brigade staff. So when Timothy told me I was going to the 1st of the 327th above the rest battalion as executive officer, it was like a dream come true. The 1st of the 327th was head and shoulders above the other two battalions. It was a close-knit, spirited crew, a unit that well reflected its long history of strong leadership. And since the new CO, Joe Rogers, had already been my immediate superior as brigade XO for almost a year, it was yet another break for me. There was no time or energy lost having to establish or prove myself with my new boss. A battalion XO actually wore two hats. One was that of battalion chief of staff, and the other, that of deputy commander of the battalion. As chief of staff, an XO's main responsibilities were to ramrod the battalion staff and run the administrative and logistics side of the unit. As deputy commander, a hat that had to be worn most carefully, if the XO made sure he adhered to the good guy or bad guy role his CO tasked him to play, and the differentiation of roles between the pair was essential, he could find himself an integral part of a damn good command team. For example, since Colonel Rogers was an unassuming, relaxed intellectual, and I was a hard-driving son of a bitch, we fell very naturally into our respective roles in the running of the first of the 327th. Like Colonel Couch to Colonel Johns in the vanguards, I snapped the whip and Rogers applied the salve. And though generally the commander played the bad guy, our arrangement suited me right down to the ground. On top of anything else, it gave me leave to kick ass and take names, and to hammer in the basics from the first day I walked into the battalion. Fire and maneuver, weapons clean and within arm's reach, wearing steel pots and proper camouflage, all these were things the troops of the 1st of the 327th knew, but they'd gotten lazy about them during 2 months on the battlefield, and laziness could kill. For the troops, the 40 days the brigade spent in the Quinyan area were characterized by snipers and booby traps, mines and monsoons, and one rice paddy after another. The paddies all looked alike, and as such made navigation hell. On one occasion, a company landed on two separate rice paddy LZs, only to find both were wrong. Booby traps were responsible for many, many casualties in the 1327 during this period. The enemy had an incredible array of the things, which they attached to the doorways of vacant houses and shrines, on gates, and especially along the tops of paddy walls. There were hand grenade booby traps with one or multiple tripwires secured to trees and rocks. There were more grenades, pins removed, held tight by a bag of rice, a rock, or a potential souvenir, a VC flag, for example, that were activated simply by picking up the item under which the primed grenade lay. Some of the best VC booby traps were made in the USA, Air Force dud cluster bomblets, modified with a pressure device and buried just below the ground level to blow when the trooper stepped on them, or 81mm and 60mm dud mortar rounds buried nose up and similarly pressure detonated. The VC used anything careless American soldiers left behind. Sea ration cans, for example, formed the basis of many lethal enemy devices. Deadlier still were the item the VC gave back from time to time, like U.S. grenades they policed up on the battlefield. A less than savvy American trooper might pick up on one of these seemingly abandoned grenades and add it to his kit. During a fight days or weeks later, he might use it and find himself dead the second he pulled the pin. The VC who'd found it first had replaced it on the battlefield only after removing the delay. This sort of thing really played with the troopers' minds. It was hell never knowing if you were going to have a foot after your next step. It also gave rise to enormous frustration and anger among them. They seldom saw Charlie at Quinyan, though he was actually much more plentiful there than he'd been at Anke, yet every day Charlie was bleeding them. They'd go into villages almost completely bereft of males, and after the women and old men had explained that all their husbands and sons were in the army or dead, and, no VC here, our soldiers would move on a few hundred meters only to have one of their number killed or wounded by a sniper holed up in the village they'd just left. The vast majority, up to 80% of the heavily populated countryside, were supportive of or influenced by the VC. Add to this that the enemy at Quinyan was a far more cunning and evasive opponent than he'd been at Anke, and his strategy of hit, bite, and run was all too effective. The coastal monsoons made things even more grim, with the onset of the rainy season, the flat, open rice paddies, already sniper, booby trap, and punji stake infested, became like rivers. At one stage, the brigade CP was actually washed away, when it was set up on ground a speck too low. When Fred Johnson's C Company used captured sampans to improve their mobility through the flooded paddies, Johnson was an invaluable asset to the 1st of the 327th. As the only officer in the battalion who'd been to Vietnam before, he was our continuity link to the war. Most of the troops just sloshed through the chest-deep water with weapons held over their heads, simultaneously trying to fight an unseen enemy who could see them for miles. Immersion foot, a condition where continuously wet feet blistered and then became a mass of painful ulcers, quickly became a serious problem among the men, the only remedy for which was to pull the sufferer out of the field and make him wear flip-flops, also known as Ho Chi Minh sandals, until his feet dried out. It was hard to disagree with the sentiments expressed in a captured VC document from this period, that U.S. troops walk in the open and look like bewildered ducks. The only consolation for us was that whoever wrote the thing, he went on to say that in action we ran slowly and looked funny, had obviously never seen Harry the Horse. Lieutenant Harry the Horse Godwin, a platoon leader in A. Abu Company, began his legend in Quy Nhon. After deploying his best sharpshooters, this 6'3" ex-Marine and top college athlete, Henderson State producer of studs Dell Evans and Scooter Burke, to name just two, would get on top of rice paddy walls and run. The purpose of the exercise was to get a concealed VC sniper to take a shot at him. Then, as the long-legged basketball star kept on running, his sharpshooters would nail the sniper. The scheme worked very well, but as cat-and-mouse games go, it was altogether too dangerous. And I quietly told George Shevlin, the Abu's capable skipper, to put his good harness on the horse and rein him in. Even so, I couldn't help but admire old Harry and wish his legend well. He was a top combat leader and a soldier revered by his men. I was not involved in many combat activities while my new battalion was at Quy Nhon, but I was involved in a few battles, most notably with the 1st Brigade staff, which I managed to alienate within about 2 minutes of leaving there and joining the 1st of the 327th. The problem began when I realized that on the user level, the battalion was playing guinea pig for the research and development R&D people back in the States, not unlike the German army scheme almost 30 years before when the Spanish Civil War became the Nazis' R&D field laboratory. Every time I turned around, our unit was being given some new piece of equipment to test on the battlefield. Then we at battalion had to send the untried wonder gear down to a company commander, who'd give it to an appropriate user. The user would try it out and report his results back to his skipper, who'd make a verbal report that would be formalized at Battalion S3 and sent on to brigade. The first to suffer for this game was the user tester, who, concurrent with his efforts to adjust to and fight the war, was being made to fumble around with equipment he'd never seen before and had no confidence in. On the ground at company level, people were already terribly overworked. And the net result of this sort of testing was snap judgments on costly and often critical equipment, not to mention enough related paperwork to drown the whole war effort. As Battalion XO, I did not agree that our job in life was to be an extension of DA's R&D, or to answer mail from higher HQ just because they sent it. "You will not answer that. We will not make that report," I'd tell my people when what I considered unreasonable requirements were sent down. "We are here to fight a war. Our primary purpose is to kick Charlie's ass, not to write reports." I was particularly annoyed with the Brigade S3, Mark Hansen, with whom I'd swapped jobs. Though it was only natural for him to send little projects down to his old unit, I really felt he laid altogether too many requirements on us. On top of that, since he knew all the good people in my battalion from his XO days, it seemed as though every other damn day he and Jim Wilson, who was now the brigade XO, were stealing the best and making them to work in their already overstaffed brigade HQ. One afternoon, a stinging reply by endorsement RBI letter came down from brigade. "Why haven't you given us an evaluation report on the feasibility and desirability of the over and under?" The RBI landed on the desk of the battalion operations officer, Major Don Hilbert. "Look," he said. "They're yelling for this report. What's the priority?" I grabbed the RBI. "Don't worry about it, Don. I'll do it." I was furious. Where the hell did they think they were, Fort Benning? If I attempted to answer the mass of futile correspondence that surrounds me, I should be debarred from all serious business of campaigning, Wellington once wrote, as I jammed a piece of paper into a typewriter. I wondered what exactly Wellington did with the stuff he didn't answer, and, more importantly, how he'd gotten away with it. "Two," I pounded out on the keys. "The octopus." I banged the carriage return so hard I thought it would break off. "Subject," I continued. "The performance of the over and under," and proceeded to report that this Rube Goldberg wonder weapon, which was an M16 with an M79 fixed underneath, was an ineffective, undesirable piece of shit. I ripped the rough draft out of the typewriter and gave it to the clerk to final type, forgetting completely that I'd addressed the thing to the octopus instead of commanding officer 1st Airborne Brigade to whom it would go. So the kid typed it up as it was. I only read through the text of the message, and off it went. Thank God the commanding officer was Colonel Timothy. Over the last year, we'd developed a wonderful relationship. He was an infinitely patient man who, as a caring father would with his wayward son, took great pains to try to smooth out my character. The dinner we shared in Hawaii, for example, on our way back from the Vietnam recon in May, became Colonel Timothy's opportunity to work on my manners. We both ordered chicken, and while the colonel properly cut his into bite-sized pieces, I picked mine up and started hoeing it down with gusto. Tim was able to ignore this, but I guess when I started licking my fingers, it got to be too much for him. "Dave," he said gently, "gentlemen do not eat chicken with their fingers." In Vietnam, since he'd sent me down to the 1st of the 327th, Colonel Timothy always backed me up and wore, on my behalf, the bitching of his brigade staff about me. The octopus memo, however, was one step too far. "You have no idea how close I was to relieving you," Tim snapped when I saw him soon after. "There you were, calling me, your commanding officer, an octopus." "Well, you are an octopus," I replied, feeling a little bad. After all, Timothy had his own octopus to contend with. The lion's share of his time was spent briefing VIPs like the Secretary of Defense and visiting senators, congressmen, and firemen. Or at least your headquarters is. They're always coming down here with their long tentacles and wrapping them around us and strangling us with red tape so we can't get on with our job. Then they whip in again and steal all our best people. The minute we get a man trained and looking good, somebody decides he's wanted at your headquarters. "That is not the issue, Dave." "That is the issue, sir." As with all my run-ins with Colonel Timothy, this one soon passed, and he even thumped his people for raiding our good men. There wasn't much he could do about the R&D testing requirements, however, and the battalion continued to play guinea pigs for many new toys, few of which were practical, GI-proof, and applicable to what we were doing in this war. And that was my real bitch with the Buck Rogers Wonder Junk Laboratory team we were an unwilling part of. The rotten M16, for example, which we'd brought over with us, was still a real sore point with me, and quickly became one for the warriors whose lives depended on its working. Many troopers picked up Soviet AK-47s off the battlefield, lugged heavier M14s or Thompson submachine guns, anything to avoid the M16, which still wasn't GI-proof and still jammed more than it fired. And even when it was working, the M16 wasn't worth a tinker's damn in the bush. Though its projectile was incredibly lethal when it struck a human target, it was easily deflected by vines, bamboo, and other undergrowth. What good, I kept asking, was a weapon that couldn't hack the jungle when we were fighting a jungle war? And since a competent soldier is first and foremost a confident soldier, how the hell were these kids expected to perform well carrying a weapon they couldn't trust? The same questions applied to the M72 light anti-tank weapon, LAW, which had an electrical firing mechanism that completely shorted out if any moisture developed inside it. In the hot, humid conditions of Vietnam, half the time a guy would be better off throwing that weapon at the enemy than trying to fire it. Ditto the PRC-25 radio handset, which was so fragile, it virtually fell apart when you blew on it, and was so susceptible to moisture that it had to be wrapped in plastic to keep it dry. The R&D people didn't always get it wrong. The PRC-25 radio, for example, less its handset, was first class and totally reliable. And the R&D guys did produce the M79 grenade launcher, the finest infantry weapon fielded since the BAR. Colonel George Couch had helped develop this compact, lightweight, reliable miracle, which ensured that infantry would never again have to find itself pinned down 50 meters from an entrenched machine gun position, too far away to toss a grenade, too close for artillery, and nearly impossible to reach and knock out without severe casualties. With the M79, one well-placed HE round could do the trick. The M79 also fired shotgun shells, which made it an excellent area fire weapon, well loved by point men and at night. Unlike the M16, with the shotgun shell, the M79 could penetrate the bush, which led to many resourceful troopers carrying both weapons at all times, the M79 to tear a hole through the jungle, and the M16 to fight in the resultant clearing. Conceptually, this made the over-and-under M16-M79 combo a winner, too. But, like everything else, the weapon, half of which, the M16, had enough problems of its own to be worked out, was being sent down to troops before anyone had even begun to address its teething problems or basic bugs. In 1965, the over-and-under was a malfunctioning suicide weapon in the hands of a young soldier, but that didn't stop us from getting them to test more and more and more. As over-and-unders, laws, and all the other too often useless and or dangerous wonder gear poured in from the states to be tested on the ground, basic essential things seldom found their way to the troops. A perfect example was the hand grenade pouch. Ever since Matt Ridgway wore an uncovered frag grenade on his harness in Korea as a showmanship trick, it seemed we'd not had a secure way to carry grenades. Despite conditions on the ground in Vietnam that pleaded for such an item, such as self-inflicted casualties arising from grenade pins catching on jungle vines and being pulled out while unsuspecting troopers walked along, the R&D and logistics people did not take time to have a look and see for themselves. The soldiers, of course, made do. The canteen cover, which we'd used in Korea to carry extra frags, became the grenade pouch in Vietnam, too. But the soldiers doing the fighting shouldn't have to make do for grenade pouches or anything else. And it was this truth that made the priority given to R&D the most incomprehensible, especially in the first few months we were in Vietnam. We had laws and M16s out the ass, which would have been a godsend if we could have counted on them to work. But in every other way, the logistics support we received during this period was criminally inadequate. General Westmoreland had made a bold decision to send combat troops to Vietnam with no logistics tail to speak of. And it was true that at the time we arrived, the roads between all provinces and most districts in the highlands had been cut, and the war effort there, and throughout South Vietnam, was on the edge of collapsing to the Viet Cong. But this fact meant little to the troopers of the 1st Brigade 101st, who were on canned sea rations for 3 solid months. There were now 125,000 Americans in Vietnam, with the number ever growing, but there were few cleaning rods or gun patches and little preservative oil for the line soldiers' weapons. About the only thing the logistics people made sure there was an ample supply of was beer for the troops to drink. While I was still at brigade, Grady Jones had finally given up on his in-country search for tires for our S3 Jeep. He wrote to his wife in America, and she sent him 2 by mail. He got them. Our stateside fatigues were too hot for tropical operations. The troopers' first-rate Corcoran leather jump boots had begun to fall apart within 2 weeks of traipsing around in the jungle. The leather cracked from the dampness and the soles fell off, and with no resupply, the result was many soldiers going into battle in scrounged sneakers or with their boots held together with camo wire and tape. Early in the piece, when General Westmoreland came up to give the first of the 101 troopers a pep talk, even he was shocked by the condition of their boots. The next day, he sent up dozens of pairs of proper jungle boots from Saigon, taken, I was told, right off the feet of the rear echelon commandos at MAC V, who had an abundance of everything while we lived like Washington's forces at a humid valley forge. Quick drying and comfortable, these new jungle boots were another positive R&D development, as were the new lightweight quick-drying jungle fatigues and jungle blankets, if only the supply system could have gotten them to the men who needed them. When, as newly appointed XO, I walked into the first of the 327th for the first time, I was appalled by the lack of just about the works. Fortunately for me and the battalion, though I didn't know it at the time, the battalion S4, whom I'll call Captain Tom Hancock, and whom I summoned to tell I wanted this situation changed muy pronto, was one of the greatest scrounger wheeler dealers in the U.S. Army, and all he'd been waiting for was a green light. I'd met Tom Hancock at Fort Campbell when I was a tag-on one of his platoon's jumps. Back then, he'd been a cheerful, gung-ho second lieutenant, ROTC distinguished military graduate, who ran one damn fine platoon. After the jump, I'd written his name down in my People to Watch and Grab Later book. Even so, it was just good luck that I'd ended up with him in the first of the 327th, and even better that, in the words of one of his peers, Hancock made an art form out of stealing. "Hancock," I'd say, "I don't care how you do it or where you get it, but we need it now. Don't tell me your troubles. Just get it done." Hancock was not the only one who got caught up in the scrounging spirit I instilled in the battalion's leaders, a carryover from Fort Mac and my D Company Vanguard days, but he was by far the best. One of his first acquisitions at Quignan was a real coup, an ice machine for the troops, set up right on the beach. Ice was cold gold in South Vietnam's blistering summer heat, and from the moment we arrived at Cam Ranh Bay, our greedy South Viet allies had taken full advantage of our need for it, raising the price in the first week from about $1 to $100 a block. While it would later be said of Hancock that stealing was a narcotic to him, he just stole and then stole that much more. I liked to think of my master scrounger as Robin Hood in fatigues, scrounging at my direction for the troops of our destitute battalion. The thing was, we all could have accepted the lean times if they had applied to everyone, but they didn't. MACV, USAF, and Army Service and Support units lived fat city while we struggled to get the basics. And then they had the balls to look down on our people when we dared to ask for a few crumbs or to go to their snazzy clubs in dress that did not meet their standards. As a result, as far as I was concerned, survival was the only law of the land. Our combat units just took what they needed to ensure the troops' welfare was looked after. When I told Hancock, for example, that I wanted the battalion to have a decent hot meal when the companies returned from the next Quignan operation, "I want steak, chicken, potatoes, not stuff out of a can, for Christ's sake. They've been on sea rations forever." Hancock, who'd once been a general's aide, put on his aide-de-camp insignia, commandeered a small boat, and motored out to a ship in the Quignan Harbor. He told the captain he represented the general and that he needed some steaks, etc., for a VIP show for some Vietnamese. Whether the ship's captain was more impressed with Hancock or with the souvenir gifts of captured weapons the S-4 presented was hard to judge, but he gave Hancock everything he wanted, times three. When the troops next got back from the paddies, the wonderful smell of grilled steaks and barbecued chicken was wafting through the camp to greet them. Hancock had scrounged an extra load of beer, too, and before long one slightly mellow, very happy battalion was moving through the chow line, courtesy of Tom Hancock. Unfortunately, one of the cooks had received a Dear John letter that morning and elected the middle of the party as the moment to blow his brains out. He lay down on the ground, stuck an M16 in his mouth, and let loose on full automatic. Though I wasn't there at the time, word had it that his hungry fellow troopers, deprived of decent food for so long, didn't miss a lick. Like the rest of the battalion scroungers, Hancock understood I'd cover for him if he got caught red-handed. Unlike the understanding I had with the other battalion scroungers, however, I found myself covering for Hancock in all kinds of ways, for all kinds of activities, including the time he walked into a Quignan bar, told a few legs there that they'd better leave, and when they didn't, he shot an M79 through the bar window. At the time, I was just thankful he wasn't drunk. When he was drunk, he was much worse. Hancock's enthusiasm for the ladies got him into even more trouble. We called him Peeping Tom when he was on the prowl, which was most of the time, and since he didn't seem to be able to do anything halfway, he fell in love fast and very, very frequently. His only failing was a somewhat indiscriminate bent. Had I known about this before the war, I would have loaded up on shares in companies that manufactured penicillin. All in all, I quickly realized Peeping Tom Hancock was going to be a handful. But maybe because he reminded me a lot of myself when I was a hell-raising kid, I put up with the bad to get the best out of the good, and the two of us got along fine. By the time the brigade left Quignan, it had been on continuous missions for 100 days. Our next stop was Phan Rang, home of the first of the 101's new permanent base camp for a much-deserved rest. The Quignan mission, codenamed Sayonara, had been very successful. Not only had we held the Korean Capital Division's hand until they set up and got through the same opening night heebie-jeebies we and the 1st Air Cav had, but we allowed the local people to harvest their rice in peace, unmolested by the Viet Cong. As well, the brigade had captured hundreds of tons of the stuff from VC caches while pushing the enemy back into the hinterland. The casualties in Quy Nhon had been mostly the result of VC snipers, mines, and booby traps, with friendly fire accounting for the remainder. In the Above the Rest battalion, we'd taken a total of 15 KIA and 51 WIA, the most tragic losses being in the recon platoon, where 5 were killed and 4 wounded when the platoon leader erroneously adjusted U.S. mortar fire right onto his own position. Gastroenteritis and malaria had also taken their tolls at Quy Nhon. Some slackers saw these illnesses as a way out of the war, and, not unlike the Korea days, went out of their way to drink rice paddy and well water without halazone tablets, or did not take their anti-malaria pills and then went around inviting mosquitoes with their sleeves rolled up and shirts unbuttoned when the sun went down. The malaria situation got so bad, and was made all the worse by a lethal new strain that targeted black troopers as its main victims, that we finally issued an order that squad leaders had to administer the huge anti-malaria horse pills to each trooper personally and record the event in a notebook. Fan Rang gave the troopers a chance to relax and have a few beers while the battalion organization went through a major reshuffle. All but one company commander was replaced, and a new 4th maneuver element was established. The company command shakeup was not by choice. It was instead based on the Army's Vietnam policy that a company CO's command tour was to be 3 months long. The philosophy behind this policy, which ended up being a policy of command musical chairs, was to spread command experience around, with the long-term view of having an army full of experienced combat commanders. In practice, however, the policy only prevented a man from becoming a good commander and leader. Just as he began to get the hang of the role, to get to know his troops and understand how to employ them, he was yanked off the line. Meanwhile, the troops had no continuity, and if a wimp replaced a stud CO, and good or bad, the best or the worst, unless a guy was relieved, he stayed with his unit 3 months. Morale and fighting confidence could plummet overnight. It was a terrible way to run a combat unit. But it was the rule, so at Fan Rang, there wasn't much we could do except make the changes and hope the new guys had what it took. A more welcome adjustment to the battalion at this time was the establishment of an all-volunteer raider-like unit called the Tiger Force. The Tiger's personnel assets came from our recon and anti-tank platoons, which at Quy Nhon I'd recommended to Colonel Rogers that we inactivate. Rogers agreed that we had little requirement for anti-tank weapons, and the unit's vehicles made them roadbound anyway. The Tiger Force troopers, in their distinctive Special Forces Tiger suits, fatigues permanently camouflaged with black and brown stripes and scrounged from the green berets by Hancock, gave the battalion a long-range reconnaissance and ambush element that would operate independently, as well as the flexibility of a handy 4th maneuver element. The need for, and value of, a fresh concept like the Tigers was intensified in the battalion by virtue of recent goings-on in the 2nd of the 502nd. Wilford Smith was gone. Now Lieutenant Colonel Henry Everett Hank Emerson was in charge, breathing fire into the O2 and implementing a kit bag of bold ideas. There's nothing like unit competition to shake off the cobwebs, and in the 1st of the 327th, we knew that unless we got off our asses, the Above the Rest would soon be below the best. Lieutenant Jim Gardner, most recently the recon platoon leader, became the 1st Tiger CO. He was a hard-working, red-headed, Dyersburg, Tennessee-born Irishman, a natural leader whose gentle demeanor belied the cocky, profane Tigers he helped create. Gardner was a no-bullshit kind of guy. The story went that he'd been kicked out of West Point after turning himself in for violating the Academy's strict honor code. Undeterred, he'd gone on to OCS and been commissioned a few months before his West Point peers. He had loads of common sense, rare among young lieutenants, and truly loved his soldiers. Unfortunately, the latter attribute would have him blaming himself the rest of his life for the 5 recon platoon deaths at Quy Nhon when he'd mistakenly put mortar fire onto his own position. In any event, Gardner was my kind of man. He had no trouble getting volunteers for the new outfit either. And soon he'd organized and begun to train his very mean two-platoon Tiger Force. As soon as things were squared away, Captain Raphael Benjamin, our new battalion surgeon, checked me into the hospital at Nha Trang. I'd picked up a severe case of gastroenteritis at Quy Nhon, probably from drinking Viet 33 beer, rumored to be made in part from formaldehyde. I'd been sick for a couple of weeks, and even the unquestionably brilliant new doc hadn't been able to bring it under control. As events proved, the docs in the hospital couldn't either, despite an entire week under their care. But while they poked and prodded and scratched their heads, trying to figure out what had gotten to me, I watched my near-empty officer's ward fill to capacity, with casualties all from the first air cav and all from a single battle, the Battle of the Nha Trang Valley. The first casualties in were from Lieutenant Colonel Harold Hal G. Moore's 1st of the 7th Gary Owen Battalion. The stories they told of their baptism of fire began as echoes of Gibraltar. Inadequate lift and piecemeal commitment, landing virtually at the enemy's front door and being incredibly outnumbered. The first day found Moore's understrength, little more than 50%, unit surrounded and caught in a vise of 2+ NVA battalions. The second day was more of the same, except that the 2, possibly 3, North Vietnamese battalions assaulting the weary 1st of the 7th were entirely fresh troops. The enemy made their main attack into Moore's C Company, inflicting heavy casualties and rendering that brave band of men ineffective as a fighting force. But the survivors hung tough and held their ground. Savage hand-to-hand combat was the order of the day as the enemy closed as tight as they could to avoid the air cav's superior firepower. Close-in employment of artillery and TAC air severely punished the NVA troops, but took its toll in friendly casualties too. The worst case being when a canister of USAF napalm was mistakenly dropped just 20 meters from Moore's CP, scorching many and burning to death one of the troopers dug in there. Despite these dire stories I heard in my hospital bed, Moore's Nha Trang fight did not smell like a disaster or a blundering success like Gibraltar. While Moore would later describe his battalion's fight as a fight-to-live situation, which was not unlike what the O2 had experienced, a critical difference between the two battles was that the commander of the 1st of the 7th was completely in control from the moment his fight began. At An Ninh, Colonel Smith was denied his control by going in with the second lift of troops. Moore, on the other hand, had been in the first lift, in the lead chopper. He'd made sure he had a chance to eyeball the LZ and the terrain surrounding it before the fight broke. Hal Moore was a comer in the Army. By the grade of lieutenant colonel, an officer's reputation was generally made or broken, and if the guy's a comer, at that point he starts being described as one star or three stars, that is, what rank he'll achieve before being retired arbitrarily in keeping with the Army's senseless age rules. At the time of the Nha Trang fight, Hal Moore was already being described as an all-the-way man, meaning four stars and probably chief of staff one day. That reputation was only enhanced by his performance at Nha Trang, where he fought his battalion brilliantly against incredible odds, taking severe casualties but inflicting even worse ones on the enemy, including a spectacular coup de grace just before his battalion was relieved and extracted from the ground they'd fought over for 40-odd hours. Using the sixth sense he'd developed over years and years of troop-leading experience and plenty of combat, just as dawn was breaking, Moore ordered a controlled mad minute with every available weapon in the battalion blazing. The net result was the annihilation of an NVA company, cut down in their attack positions just moments before they were set to launch an assault on Moore's unit. As the week passed, Nha Trang casualties continued pouring into the hospital at Nha Trang, but the mood of these, my latest ward mates, was as grave as Moore's men's had been elated. They were members of Lieutenant Colonel Robert McDade's 2nd of the 7th Cav Battalion, which had relieved Moore's forces, and that very same morning walked right into an estimated 500-man NVA ambush. The word I was getting from the wounded air cav officers was disaster, annihilation almost to the man of 2nd of the 7th units as big as company size. Despite this, however, and despite the fact that American KIA would number more than 200 by the time the battle ended little more than a week later, both at the height of the fighting and when it was over, COMUS MACV General William Westmoreland confidently stated that the Battle of Ya Drang was an unprecedented victory for American units in the war. Victory is one of those words, as hard to define as light, moderate, and heavy, three more of those words that MACV had chosen as the official words to describe friendly combat casualties to the press corps and the folks back home. These words would have pleased Humpty Dumpty sitting on the wall in the world inside Alice's looking glass. "When I use a word," he said, "it means just what I chose it to mean, neither more nor less." Victory had been used to describe the first of the 101's near disaster at An Ninh. Now it was being used again to describe Ya Drang, where, despite the incredible NVA losses, official U.S. totals unconfirmed by eyewitnesses were well over 1,000 enemy KIA. Nowhere near did the Americans come to beating the oft-stated equation Ho Chi Minh had taunted the French with during the Indochina War. "You will kill 10 of our men, and we will kill one of yours. And in the end, it will be you who tire of it." Ya Drang put another word, ambush, into the Humpty Dumpty dictionary, too. The destruction of McDade's battalion didn't fit in very well with the otherwise victorious fight. So despite all evidence to the contrary, platoon leaders were telling me how the hidden enemy had been everywhere, even dug into the tops of the 6-foot-tall anthills a few feet off the ambushed trail. The 1st Air Cav's assistant division commander, Brigadier General Richard Knowles, told reporters McDade's battalion had not been ambushed, that they'd probably surprised the NVA unit that subsequently destroyed them. In terms of scale, in terms of the nature and number of the enemy, and in the way the NVA initially stood and fought instead of running away, the Battle of the Ya Drang Valley was unprecedented in America's involvement in Vietnam. Also, Ya Drang, and in fact the entire Central Highlands Play Me campaign, which had begun 5 weeks earlier and of which Ya Drang was a part, heralded a major change in the face of modern warfare. The first real test of America's air mobile might proved in combat the wide-ranging capabilities and worth of the helicopter for the movement of troops and artillery, the evacuation of casualties through medevac choppers, and resupply. The fact that the air cav covered enormous distances throughout the battle in comparatively insignificant amounts of time certainly changed the complexion of warfare as any of us knew it, but especially for the North Vietnamese, whose previous enemy, the French, had, as a rule, hacked their way 1 foot after the other through the highlands at a maximum speed of 500 meters per hour. The big question of Ya Drang was why the NVA stood its ground in the face of our awesome firepower and allowed such diabolical casualties among its ranks. Indeed, a significant part of the high-level American ecstasy after Ya Drang was its proof of the suitability of a war of attrition, the style of war General Westmoreland was waging in Vietnam. But while Westy opined that the reason the NVA stood was to protect a new supply and staging base in the mountains above Ya Drang, it was John Paul Vann, who by now had quit the Army as a lieutenant colonel and had returned to Vietnam as an Agency for International Development aid civilian advisor and recognized expert on the situation there, who correctly suggested that the NVA's purpose at Ya Drang, and hang the expense in lives, was to figure out how to beat the Americans' incredible firepower and amazing mobility. And they accomplished their mission. Sure, they were knocked on their asses and took a long time to recover, and they had to cut back on their fledgling Stage 3 set-piece battles and return to Stage 2 guerrilla hit-and-run operations. But from the fight, they also learned to hug the belt of their enemy, to come in as close as they could in order to neutralize the killing power of our artillery and air support. At Ya Drang, the North Vietnamese learned how to fight us. And looked at in this way, even if the battle was an unprecedented victory for the Americans in our war of attrition, it was an equally unprecedented victory for our enemy in their protracted guerrilla war. The brigade was conducting local security missions around our Phan Rang base camp by the time I returned to my battalion. The above-the-rest training program we'd established, which incorporated lessons learned so far, was also in full swing, but other than that, nothing was happening, and life at our base camp home would have been boring beyond words if all the free time hadn't given me the opportunity to get to know the young officers in the 1st of the 327th and find out what they were made of. Cards being just about the only nightlife Van Rang had to offer, this getting to know you generally took place around a poker table. I cleaned out most of the guys on a regular basis, but as testimony to their mettle, they always came back for more. Lieutenant George Perry from Abu Company, for example, was one of the worst card players I'd ever met. It finally reached the point where I'd tell him to stay home and get a good night's sleep, but I'd be happy to prorate his losses against his track record and bill him in the morning. Whatever I said, though, Perry was always at the table that night. Sparkling entertainment at the officer card parties was provided by Battalion Assistant S3 John Dalton Howard, a.k.a. Gentleman John, a West Point lieutenant who'd struck me as being outstanding the first minute I laid eyes on him. Johnny was a very serious young soldier with a John Denver wholesome look about him. Underneath, he was also a great practical joker and one of the funniest guys I'd ever met. He viewed playing poker with me somewhat as Hank Lund did. That dumb I'm not, my former assistant S3 now making his mark as the top company commander in Emerson's stable of O2 studs would say when asked to participate. Johnny came to every game, but when asked to play, he'd usually sit back.